I'd like to begin by thanking you for the opportunity to come and stand before you and preach out of God's Word. It really is an honor to me to have the opportunity. I was a member at a congregation from 2001 till about 2015, and there was a waiting list, and it might be a year before you got an opportunity to speak in front of the congregation. So that's not lost on me. I do appreciate it. I want to begin by reading, as an introduction to my lesson tonight, a bit out of Job. Job chapter 38, verses 1 through 6, and that should be up on the screen behind me. By the way, that picture in the background is of the current river. I took that on a hike with Claire. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who set its measurements, since you know? Or who stretched the line on it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone?" God humbles Job for his ignorance. I think by any standard that we set as Christians, as students of the Bible, we would say that Job handled his circumstances admirably. We would say he did quite well. But God, near the very end, God doesn't think the same way that you and I do, does he? He says, "You instruct me." This gives us an insight into the attitude that God has toward disbelief. We live in a John 3:16 society where God so loved the world, and he does. God loves the world. But we don't like, and our society in general doesn't like to talk about condemnation. They don't like to talk about the hard things that cause us to have to change, the severity of God. I think us specifically, those that serve God, we have a greater difficulty talking about the severity of God when it pertains to us. When we're talking about people of the world, it's easy. We can condemn them. Their deeds are evil. We have abortion amongst us. We have homosexuality paraded in front of us daily. Sexuality paraded in front of us in media, commercials, radio. It doesn't matter. It's everywhere. And we condemn it, and rightly so. But we find it difficult, I believe, to take the attitude that we will be judged as well. Disbelief, sin, provokes God to anger. Again, Job handled those circumstances admirably. I don't think anyone in this room would disagree with that. Maybe you could have handled it better. I know Mike Smith couldn't have or wouldn't have. But this passage, it sets the tone for our study tonight. Because God deserves our fear and respect. This lesson is not for fools like Colin Kaepernick, who kneels out of disrespect to the nation's flag. This lesson is not for the fools, the athletes that kneel in the Olympics or in whatever. This is for those that believe. Tonight, I want to talk to Mike Smith. I want to talk to us, followers of God. You see, because Job was a follower of God, and you saw the type of stern reprimand that he believed for just a moment of disbelief. Tonight, we're going to build a case for why we should respect God and how he would have us to live. In Jeremiah chapter 5 and 22, the religion of the Jews was hypocritical. In this verse below, God proclaims judgment on his people because they did not fear him. Quite simple, Jeremiah 5:22, "Do you not fear me, declares the Lord? Do you not tremble in my presence?" God will judge us. Romans 6:23 tells us that sin is death. God judged Sodom and Gomorrah harshly. He judged Nebuchadnezzar. 1 Peter 4:17 tells us that we will be judged first. We're the household of God. We will receive judgment first. And if we're to be judged the same way that we judge others, we better have a healthy fear and respect for God. I don't know how you are in your life, but I know how Mike Smith is. And I give some pretty harsh judgment. And I know it's unwarranted many times. Respect. 1 Samuel 12:24. Samuel shows the people how ungrateful they are by asking for a king. He explains to the people that you owe God respect. Simply, look around. Look what's happened to you. You owe God respect. 1 Samuel 12:24. Only fear the Lord and serve Him in truth with all your heart. For consider what great things He has done for you. We've read the New Testament. We've read the Old Testament. We know how God's early people were. They praised Him and they served Him and then they fell. And then they came back up and then they fell. But Samuel's telling them, you owe God your respect. And by respect, he's talking about the way that they act. The whole point of what I want to talk about tonight is our respect, the honor that we give God, should be manifested in the way that we act, in the way that we speak. Through Jesus, we have hope. God created the heavens and the earth. I love nature. I love the outdoors, water, trees, clean air. All of this to me is evidence of God, evidence of His creation. I don't know if you feel the same way, but it's simple for me when I step foot out my front door and I look at the trees and I look at the sun and I look at the beautiful grass and I know that God lives. But we also have hindsight. We can look back and we see what Jesus did. On these two points alone, we owe God reverence. We owe Him our reverence. Just the ability to wake up and see the beauty, to know that we have the hope of heaven. Say that again. We have the hope of heaven. Just for that glimmer of hope. Even if it's the narrow path that few will pass through, we have that opportunity. We owe God reverence. When we have that reverence, when we have that fear for God, it will define our actions. I think sometimes I feel like I'm doing a good job. I was there on Wednesday. I sang the songs. I prayed the prayer. I may not have stood up. My knee sometimes hurts. I was there Sunday morning. I was there Sunday night. But Monday morning, I've forgotten what I did the day before. I'm not giving God glory. Jesus describes the Pharisees as whitewashed tombs in Matthew 23. I can't think of a more descriptive term of evil. Polished on the outside, but rotten bones on the inside. You ever smelt a dead animal? I know, surely, at this point in your life you have. It's terrible. It's unbearable. And that smell is what Jesus is describing of the heart of the Pharisees. But they wanted to look pious. If we ignore the teachings of Jesus, remember the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith, then we too are in danger of His judgment, of being considered whitewashed tombs. Leviticus 11:44, God says, or Moses writes, as God says, "Be holy, or I am holy." Real simple and easy to understand. Remember, this is what the true meaning of the law was. God was saying through Moses, "I want you to be different. I don't want you to act like the Gentiles do. I want you I want you to be set apart from them. I want you to know the difference between good and evil. You will be distinguished from your neighbors. But remember, God wants the actions. He wants the way we live, not just rote repetition of a practice. He wants our heart. And it's not easy, is it? A lot of the teachings of Jesus in Matthew 5, in Galatians 5 and 22, the fruit of the Spirit, they're contrary to how we want to act. But that's what God expects. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight, practical application. There's plenty of verses describing sin and what sin is specifically. But I want us to focus on how God would have us to live. Just like God's first people, we're to be set apart from the world. Living by the fruit of the Spirit is the opposite of the world. If we practice these things, we will be 180 degrees different from the way the world is. We'll look foolish. We'll look uneducated and simple and weak. You remember Jesse Ventura when he was running for governor of Minnesota or Michigan, whichever state it was. He said Christians need a crutch. The Bible is a crutch. And he's insinuating Christians are weak. Christians, they don't have what we have. And when you live this way, that's the way the world is going to see you. If you exhibit love when it's unmerited, you're a fool. If you're smiling and you have joy because you have the hope of heaven, you're a hayseed moron. And that's the way the world looks at us. The remainder of our lesson, we're going to look at each of these attitudes and attempt to define them in order to show respect to God. Remember, this is, God wants action. He wants these things to define the way we live our life and who we are. First is love. This definition I have posted on the screens from dictionary.com. All of them are dictionary.com. A profoundly tender, passionate affection for another person. I love my wife. I love my children. It's extremely easy to love them. But what about the people that don't love me in return? My wife dutifully makes me a breakfast in the morning, and I love it. My children will scratch my back anytime I ask, and they don't argue or fight, and I love it. They're easy for me to love. But again, what about the person that doesn't do something for me? We are to love one another. Again, I'm talking about us as Christians. I'm talking about those that serve God in this room. Loving one another involves a deep concern for the well-being of someone other than yourself. Love involves service above self. I was a member of the Rotary Club for a little over 10 years, and that's the motto of the Rotary Club, service above self. I've always thought that was a noble calling. Love involves commitment. Love involves friendship. But love is a verb. It doesn't describe. Love is something you do. It means we help each other. We depend upon one another. We lift up the broken. Again, there are ample opportunities to serve one another. Those that aren't as fortunate as we have been. Those that are broken. Those that haven't been blessed, maybe the way that we've been blessed. Love for someone else means you're going to love the broken. I used to be a member of a congregation. There were two professional fishermen. Two. And I'm talking guys that went, they were on television, they went to the fishing shows, they were paid to go to the fishing shows, they were paid to teach professional fishing, and all of the guys, including yours truly, I wanted to be friends with them. I got in line to talk to these guys. I couldn't wait to get to know them. But What about the guys that weren't so accomplished? I'll admit, I didn't pay much attention to them because I was waiting in line to talk to the professional fishermen. Because that was what was important to me, and it was important to most guys. But we have people that are broken, people that don't have the things that we have. We have that amongst us. And love says that we're going to lift them up. We have patience with one another. I know if you hang out with me, I'm going to agitate you at some point. If you spend much time with me, I'm going to say something I'm sure that probably gets under your skin a little bit. I don't do it on purpose. It just comes out. But as Christians, we have patience with one another. We recognize there's 20,000 people in Rolla, there's 5,000 people in St. James, and maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people that consider this their shopping area. And all we have is 80 of us. We need to be together. We need to love one another and have a deep care and concern, because this is all we have. This is our family. Not those people out there. Not our blood relatives. Blood means nothing. This is what binds us together. And if I agitate you, I hope you'll forgive me. And I'm not, honestly, that's not a joke. Maybe not all of you hung around me very much, but typically I'm going to get on your nerves after a while, and I hope you'll forgive me. We need to forgive one another. We need to be generous with one another. If we have means, and there are those that need help, we give it to them. And we don't look for something in return, and we don't tell everyone what we've done. Again, this is our family. We are the ones who are responsible and love one another. And we need to offer forgiveness willingly. You ever had to beg for forgiveness? Carol and I just watched a movie, and just getting her to watch a movie is a miracle. But she watched a movie with us the other night, and this young man was physically abused by his father. And years later, the father begged him. He said, "Please forgive me. Will you please forgive me?" And the father was poorly educated, and he was a very physical, abusive man. And the son said, "I can't forgive you. I will never forgive you." And that son could not move forward in his life until he forgave his father. He couldn't have a career. He couldn't have success. He couldn't find himself until he offered that forgiveness. And it's just a movie. But there's some truth in that. If we can't forgive one another, and we come into this room, and Robert just, he can't stand me. He's heard enough Texas stuff. And he goes to this side of the room, and maybe I walk over to that side of the room, so he goes to that side of the room. That's not love. That's not service to one another. Next is joy. The emotion of great delight or happiness caused by something exceptionally good or satisfying. Keen pleasure, elation. Matthew Henry describes joy as cheerfulness in conversation with one another. But I say joy is bigger than that. Joy is more than just cheerful conversation. Joy is what we make our life. Some people make life their riches, their cars, their homes, their vacations, these worldly possessions that will pass. That's their joy. But what should our joy be? Our joy is salvation. Our joy is our hope of heaven. Our joy is the fact that when we perish from this earth, we can go to heaven and receive a reward. If we walk around our lives and our joy is heaven, you can't help but smile. But if you are us, if I'm looking and my joy is a shiny new car, and my joy is a trip to Europe, or my joy is a million-dollar home, it will never be enough. You will never be satisfied. There are always more trips. There's always a new car that needs to be purchased, always a new house. There is no satisfaction in those things, temporary satisfaction at best. Our joy is our service and love and our hope to live with God one day. And if we have that joy, you'll see, we'll have a smile on our face. It'll be tough to wipe off. Yeah, there are tough things happen in life. It's going to be tough to smile all the time. But most of the time, we'll have a smile when our joy is in God. Peace. Dictionary.com says it's a state of mutual harmony between people or groups, especially in personal relations. When I read this, the first thing I thought of is President Reagan used to say, peace through strength. He wasn't the first one that said it. That's been said hundreds of years before he did. Peace through strength. But on a personal level, what does that mean? Peace isn't won by avoiding conflict. When we sin, others must have the courage to confront our mistake. I think that's the most difficult thing in the whole world, is to stand up to someone and tell them they've sinned. It just is. It's rhetorical, don't answer me. But have you ever done it? Have you ever said, Mike, I heard you use foul language that is not becoming of a Christian. That is not what's written in the New Testament. That is not what will get you to heaven. Most people are scared to death to do that. Mostly because of our reaction. Our reaction, I might get mad at you. Maybe I'll cuss at you. Who knows? Rather than confront the sin, we just go on down the road, maybe gossip. Hey, did you hear what Mike said? Can't believe he said that. Christians should never say that. And then we gossip about it. But you have to have the strength. Peace through strength. You have to have the courage to confront the sin. And when we are confronted, we also have to have the courage to accept the admonition and be honest with ourselves to make that change. That is the peace of Jesus. It takes tremendous courage to confront a brother in sin. And again, we must look at ourselves introspectively and determine if we are indeed sinning and thank our brother for standing up. Thank them. How hard is that? You're right. I used vulgar language. I'm embarrassed. Thank you for having the courage to preach Jesus to me, because I want to go to heaven. And I know foul language won't get me there. Patience. This is a big one. Dictionary.com says it's the bearing of provocation, annoyance, misfortune, or pain without complaint, loss of temper, irritation, or the like. James 3:2 says we all sin. If we're not patient with one another, there will be no church. Bell rings, we're out. We get out as fast as we can because I can't stand Mike Smith. He just keeps talking about how cold it is here. I'm tired of it. You know, we have to have patience with one another. What did Jesus say? How many times will we forgive someone? 7 times 70. Woe to the man who will not forgive his brother. Let me tell you a quick story. I told you there was a professional fisherman at one, the last congregation I was at. His name's Roland Williams. He's since passed away, Lou Gehrig's disease. Carol and I placed membership September 11th, 2001. You can imagine why I remember that date. And a friend told me, hey, you got to meet Roland Williams. Roland's a professional fisherman. He goes to the fishing shows. Maybe you've seen him on television. This guy catches big fish and a lot of fish. You're going to want to meet this guy. And I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait to meet him. And everyone, all the guys, the end of services, went and talked to Roland. And when I finally got to talk to him, I had so many questions. I wanted to learn how to wade fish in salt water just like he did. Typically, I just took a rod and I clunked it out with a dead shrimp on the bottom and nothing happened. Crab would steal the bait. But Roland would have stringers of the biggest. He caught a trout one time. The eyeball was this big, the size of a quarter. Anyway, sorry, I could go on and on. I loved Roland. He was very patient with me. Everybody told me, don't ask him a bunch of questions. It gets on his nerves. That's because that's all. Everybody just sees him as a professional fisherman. And they don't see him as another Christian. They don't see him as a brother who may need help or someone who may have something else to say other than fishing. That's not what I didn't care. I want to know how to catch fish. And it took me a year of talking to him before he finally allowed me to go fishing with him, because I got on his nerves. He didn't want to have to answer all of these questions. He didn't want to, you know, I asked him what kind of rod, what kind of reel, what kind of line, what kind of lure, what time of the day, what time of the year, what color of the lure. All of these legitimate questions I was asking him, and I had my notebook in hand, and that's not what he wanted. So we go fishing. What's he talk about? He talks about the gospel. He talks about a lady at the golf course that he got to come to worship, and he converted her. He talked about God creating the world. He said, watch when that sun comes up. That's God. That's all he talked about. But that's not what I was interested in. I was interested in fishing. Roland was very patient with me. We ended up becoming really good friends and spending a lot of time together. But I learned a lesson in patience. Keep my mouth shut. Listen every now and then and learn something other than what I'm interested in selfishly. And I gained a rich friendship as a result of that. Kindness. When we're hurt or offended, I think we tend to react in anger and bitterness. Kindness, though, leads us to react really the opposite. It's unnatural. If someone is rude to you, what do you want to do back? I know what I want to do. I want to get them back good. I'd love it. I always dreamed, you know, in a public meeting, somebody says something mean to me and I've got the perfect comeback, you know, to shame them or put them in their place. That's not kindness, though, is it? It takes work to be kind. You have to restrain yourself. You have to think of how would I want to be treated in this circumstance. Think of a mother of small children that ask a million questions. How does she respond? Does she get frazzled and, shut up! I can't take it anymore! But a mom doesn't do that. She answers them lovingly, kindly. They ask that question again, and then they ask it again. And she responds in kindness. And in kindness, she shows them the love of Jesus. Children learn about Jesus, how Jesus answered questions. From their mother, a patient woman. And fathers, we need to be that way too. I'm really convicting myself. Ask my kids. I don't do well when you ask the same question over and over and over. Anyway, you can see why I need to work on this. Goodness, moral excellence, virtue. Jesus told the rich young ruler in Mark 10:18 that no one is good but God alone. Just following God's commands are not enough. We must cultivate excellence in character that will drive our behavior. Remember, being good isn't just avoiding poor behavior. It's doing the right thing. It'd be like a mom spanking her kid for doing wrong and then not telling them why or how to do what is right. The rich young ruler had a problem with his heart. We should search the heart of God and find out how we can be good to one another and not just obedient. Being good is hard. It's like being kind. It takes work. It takes effort. And this rich young ruler had everything. Remember, he checked all of the boxes. And what did Jesus say? He said, sell everything and give it to the poor. Whoa! I'm not sure about this. He went away sad. That's not what he wanted to hear. Goodness is tremendously difficult. Faithfulness. Steady in allegiance or affection, loyal, constant. God's word is the very foundation of our faith. If His word isn't true, we have no hope. We must keep our word to one another. We must be trustworthy. If I lie to you, how many more times are you going to trust me? I think you'll probably give me one shot. That Mike Smith lied to me. I don't think I ever want to take his word again. Our word has to mean something. Let our yes be yes and our no be no. If we don't keep our word to one another, I don't believe God will keep His promise to us. Our hope of heaven, if I'm a liar to you, our hope of heaven is shrunk. It's disappeared. We have to be faithful to one another. Gentleness. Not severe, rough, or violent, mild. 1 Thessalonians 2:7, Paul describes gentleness as that of a nursing mother. I can't think of a more beautiful or appropriate example of gentleness. Can you think of anything more vulnerable or caring or gentle than a mother nursing her baby? I remember Carol telling me when she nursed, sometimes it hurt. And how do you respond? She did not strike the child. But can you imagine the pain, that hurting? You might want to respond. Oh, you bit me? I'll bite you. I'll hurt you back. But that's not what gentleness is. We don't deal harshly with one another. We don't deal harshly with a baby. We, too, should be gentle with one another. I get it. Sometimes people may get under your skin a little bit. And I tell you, I admit it. I know not long after talking to me, I might get under your skin. I know my friend Roland said, yeah, it took me about a year. I finally had to swallow my pride and I started talking to you. But he was gentle with me. He wasn't rude. Can you imagine going up to talk to someone and they turn? Nope, I don't want to talk to Mike. Got to get away. We have to be gentle with one another. And again, Paul talks about how gentleness as a nursing mother. Self-control. Self-control takes discipline. It's delayed gratification for a greater cause. The definition here says control or restraint of oneself or one's actions or feelings. 1 John 2:16 reads, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father, but from the world." Some of us, I believe, are tempted by gossip. Some of us are tempted maybe by the opposite sex or by the wealth of others. But we have to be honest with ourselves in regard to what tempts us and work toward self-control. There was a congregation in Texas, we did not attend there, but I had friends there. One of the elders sought after the preacher's wife. He pursued her in private. And they ended up committing adultery. And they had intended on just leaving one day. And not coming back, not telling anyone, just going. And then I think the preacher's wife backed out, changed her mind. And then went forward and admitted. It practically destroyed the congregation. Congregation lost a lot of members. People left. People moved. It was very destructive. And I would submit to you, self-control, selfishness, sin is what almost destroyed an entire congregation. It almost destroyed the two marriages. It turned out that both spouses ended up forgiving and taking the other back. But the congregation was damaged. Again, Christians need to exhibit self-control. In conclusion, 1 Peter 1:14, "As obedient children, do not be conformed to the former lusts which were yours in your ignorance, but like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all your behavior, because it is written, 'You shall be holy, for I am holy.'" We read that in Leviticus. First part of this verse says, "Do not be conformed to the former lusts." We just read Galatians 5:22. We went through all of those terms. Those, the opposite of those, are the former lusts. Those are the things of the world that we need to avoid. We need to practice respect for God in our behavior, respect for one another, because God deserves it. He created the entire universe He gives us the hope of heaven. God deserves our respect. He deserves far more than that. But the best we can give Him is our worship, our service, and our respect. And we change our behavior when we do so. Thank you for your kind attention. I appreciate, again, the opportunity. I haven't made the invitation to come forward or the invitation to be baptized, but we do make that opportunity available as Gabe sings the song of invitation. Thank you.